What they had was mostly conjecture, with a few names and background. They sketched in the story of the Jerusalem artichoke scam and the general belief that Bill Judd Sr. had a hidden account somewhere, that Judd Jr. was in desperate financial straits and the death of his father would make them worse, not better, that Jr. might be embezzling from the hidden fund. "Why didn't he just keep that money instead of doing this ethanol thing?" Pirelli asked. "Maybe a couple of reasons," Virgil said. "First, there might not have been enough money left in the account. Not enough to take care of all his debts and provide him with some security. He's getting to be an older guy. Second, it's coming out of a bank account, somewhere. There'll be a paper trail. It's not that easy to do things in cash anymore. People want checks and wire transfers and financial controls. The way they did it, it looks like the old man Judd put up some starter cash for an ethanol plant. They actually make some ethanol and sell it, probably. But we think they're also running this little chemical factory on the side. I wouldn't be surprised if they own some land around the plant to grow corn for processing," Stryker said. "Then they'd be on the up and up ordering all the chemicals they'd need. The smell of the meth processing could be passed off as just another stink from the ethanol plant. But basically there's no indication whatsoever that this ethanol plant has anything to do with meth," one of the agents said. "I suppose that depends on how imaginative you are," Virgil said. "We've got a bunch of dead people. We've got a nutcase preacher who's tied to the core. We've got a guy desperate for cash. We've got them buying anhydrous ammonia by the tanker truck, and they're making alcohol by the tanker truck. And we've got hard guys coming and going in the night with 5-gallon cans of gas. These are the same guys who could act as a collecting system for the hard-to-get chemicals. You get one dumbass driving around a metro area buying a package of diet pills at every possible store, and you can get pounds of the stuff every day. You get 10 dumbasses driving around doing it in 10 different metro areas, and you can get a ton of it in a week. We know that they're connected into a distribution system through the core. That could also be a collection system for the other stuff they need. I mean, maybe they're selling the ethanol as moonshine at $5 a quart, but I doubt it. So if these are small-town guys, how does he afford an ethanol plant?" another agent asked. "You ever seen one?" Stryker asked. "Ethanol plant?" The DEA guy shook his head. "Not that I know of. There are some ethanol plants that look like grain elevators. In fact, most of them do. And the newest ones look like little refineries. But some of the older ones, going 3, 4, 5 years back, look like a big garage. Basically, an ethanol plant is a still. What they're making is moonshine. That's all it is." Pirelli said, "For the past 2 years, there's been an ocean of crank flooding the area between the Mississippi River and the Rockies. Most of it's going down to Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, Houston. Heavy stuff, pure white. Not that brown stuff you see out of coffee pots. We've been going crazy trying to find the source. One possibility we have is that it has something to do with the core. The guys who are dealing more than a few ounces are all tied in." "What about Dale Donald Evans?" Stryker asked. "He ought to be home by now." Pirelli's eyebrows went up. He took a cell phone from his pocket, scrolled, and punched. A minute later he asked, "Get him?" He listened and then said, "Stay just like that. He didn't take the gas cans out of the truck?" He listened some more and then said, "Call me." To Stryker, "He got home 45 minutes ago. Doesn't have a garage. Parked the truck." "He's got a bad taillight," Virgil said. "You could stop him on a violation. Have the cop check the gas cans. It's a little thin, but it'd hold." "Lucky thing about the taillight," one of the agents said. When they were done with the briefing, Pirelli said, "Okay, what we'd really like is for you two to take the day off. Enjoy your Saturday afternoon, enjoy your Sunday. I'll call you Monday or Tuesday." "Monday," Virgil said. "Or Tuesday. There's this Sioux Indian guy about to drift into Madison, South Dakota, where his car is going to break down. He'll be there for a while, watching that plant, talking with the locals. In the meantime, we're going to be on Dale Donald Evans like yellow on a Chinaman. If this turns out to be what you think it is, we'll give you a call. We appreciate the help of local authorities, and when we take down the Reverend Fur, you'll be right there with us." Stryker slapped his thighs and said, "Sounds like a deal. to Virgil. Sound like a deal to you? Virgil said. Okay with me if it's okay with everybody. One of the agents said to Virgil, You know, Modest Mouse music is really sort of gay. Chapter 15 On the way back to Bluestem, Virgil said to Stryker, I don't want to bring you down, but I don't think Fur killed Schmidt or the Gleasons. Might have killed Judd, using the Gleasons as cover. That brings me down, Stryker said. Thing is, the Gleasons and the Schmidts, that has the smell of craziness about it. Stryker, let me share something with you, Virgil. George Fur is pure 100% grade-A high-test batshit. In the wrong way, Virgil said. If we're right about him, if they've been pumping meth out of that ethanol plant, then you've got a guy who believes in organization and networks and conspiracies. He sets up cover companies. He raises startup funding. The guy who killed the Gleasons and the Schmidts, this guy believes in chaos and oblivion. He believes he's the only real soul in an ocean of puppets. Oh, fuck. Stryker peered out his side window, watching the summer go by. Oh, fuck me. Speaking of fucking you, how are things on the Jesse front? Shut up. They went straight to the house of Chris Olofsson, the accountant. Stryker banged on the door, off and on, for 3 or 4 minutes before she finally came to the door in a dressing robe. Come in. I'd just finally gotten to sleep. We haven't been to sleep yet, Stryker said. What'd you find? She shook her head. Junior's goose is cooked. How cooked? Very cooked. Junior had gotten all the tax-free gifts he was entitled to, some $2 million. That meant the total estate was taxable. But the total estate was less than anyone had expected, at a little more than $6 million, and that included assets of $2 million in loans to Junior. The state and federal government are going to want roughly $4 million. That means that Junior won't get anything. He just won't have to pay off the loans. But the fact is, if Jesse Lehman is entitled to half of the estate, Junior is going to owe her $1 million. If you look at his earnings from the subways at face value, he might just be able to do it. However, Stryker repeated, if you look at the tax returns, everything seems okay. But I know the kind of money you make from a fast food place, because I do all the McDonald's and Burger Kings and Arby's around here. A Subway does not do a McDonald's business. But Junior's places do, according to his tax returns. They are selling sandwiches as fast as they can make them, which is strange, because if you go into one of Junior's stores, there's hardly anyone in there. Virgil said, He's reporting more than he's earning? Yes, I think so. He's piping in money from somewhere else, running it through the subways, paying taxes on it, and then it's clean. He's running a money laundry. Ah, Stryker said. The downside of that is... She hesitated, and then peered over the top of her glasses at Stryker. The downside is... Your friend, Jesse Lehman, could make a claim for half of the loan assets, half of the Subway franchises, and then find out that there's nothing there. The most successful Subways in Minnesota suddenly can't sell a sandwich. So he's broke? Not as long as he keeps running those Subways. But without the extra money, he's in trouble. Is he sticking it someplace, like his old man? Can't tell you that, she said. But I can tell you he owes taxes and penalties on all his illegal earnings. So after the IRS gets finished with him... She shrugged. Virgil said, Chris, I want all the paper back. I don't want you to mention to anybody that you talked to us. I don't think you're in danger, but I can't promise that you're not. Some people have probably seen us come in here. I'm sure. So word will get around town. You want to be very careful for the next couple of days. Then what? Then we'll see, Virgil said, grinning at her. As they were leaving, Virgil asked her, You mentioned Jim's friend Jesse Lehman. Would you have any more specifics on that friendship? She shrugged and smiled at Stryker. Word was, you were seen heading up toward the Dell. Stryker said, I'm moving to California. She's a very pretty girl, Olafsson said. Too bad about her inheritance. At the courthouse, Stryker got out of the truck and said, I'm running out of gas. Too old for this overnight shit. Yeah, I'm gonna take a nap, Virgil said. Gotta call Joni. Maybe you should call Jesse. The four of us could go out somewhere. Stryker yawned. I'll ask Jesse. Give me a call when you get up, but not too early, like 6:30 or 7:30. Joan's cell phone kicked over to the message service. Virgil said, I'm just going to bed. Jim and I were talking. Maybe the four of us could go out tonight later on. He took a while going to sleep. Went down deep when he did. His cell phone rang 5 times before he realized what it was. By the time he got to it, it had stopped ringing. He punched up the number, didn't recognize it, but it was from the Twin Cities. He redialed, and Shrake came up. Hey, Flowers, it's me and Jenkins. We're looking at your old guys. You want us to run them in? Jeez, Shrake, where are you? In their living room. Their daughter's living room, Shrake said. You want us to take her in, too? Shrake, what are you doing? Where are you? Okay, then, Shrake said. We'll leave her. I don't think she'd last too long with all the muffin crunchers down at Ramsey. They can hear you, Virgil said. You're scaring them, right? You got that right, Shrake said, and he laughed. Virgil said, okay. You tell them to glue their asses to the couch, and I'll be there in 4 hours. Tell them if they go anywhere, I honest to God... Wait. Let me talk to them. Let me talk to Gerald. A moment later, Gerald came on the line, and Virgil said, Gerald, you motherfucker, you know something about that picture. I'm going to put your ass in jail, and your wife's ass in jail, for murder, if I don't find out what it is. You sit there. I'm leaving Bluestem right now, and I'll be there in 4 hours. Now give me Shrake. Shrake came back up and said, yeah? Take the rest of the day off, Virgil said. It's Saturday, dickweed. This was my day off. Then take tomorrow off, too. I don't think Gerald's going anywhere. Give me the address. The daughter's name is what, Jones? Cornelia Jones, that's correct. D.O.B. 61847. We're at her house in Apple Valley. Get off at Cliff Road. Virgil had grill-mounted LED flashers on the Forerunner and a removable roof-mount flasher that plugged into a cigarette lighter. He'd never used them for criminal inquiries, but occasionally did use them when he felt like driving fast. He called the Highway Patrol District Office in Marshall, told them that he was making an emergency run back to the cities east on I-90 and north on I-35 as part of a murder investigation, and asked them to advise the other districts, and told them that he'd be using the flashers. He got Joni as he left town. I didn't think you'd be up yet, she began. I'm heading for the cities in a big hurry, Virgil said. Back tomorrow, I hope. What happened? Got the Johnstones, and they know some shit. Tell Jim when he gets up. He'll be getting up in an hour or so. I will. Be safe, Virgil. The Forerunner would do an honest 90, but at 100 it was breathing hard and starting to move around the road. Virgil backed off to 98, put it on cruise control, turned on some music, and made it into the south end of the cities in 2.5 hours. Got off at the main Apple Valley exit, drove in circles for a while, finally cut Roan Stallion Lane, which was half a block long, and pulled up in the driveway of Cornelia Jones. The house was suburban comfortable. Its distinguishing characteristic was that the lawn was essentially a field of hosta plants. Thousands of them, like a midget army from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Virgil dragged a rocking chair halfway across the living room so that he could plant his face a foot from Gerald Johnstone's and said, Gerald, you are a bad man. You are covering up for a guy who's murdered at least 5 people. You were lying to me the other day, and I knew it. And now you've dragged your wife and daughter into it. This is a criminal conspiracy. Gerald started to blubber, which wasn't attractive in an elderly man. Carol Johnstone patted his thigh and said, Tell him, Jerry. Tell him, and it'll be all right. The daughter, a stolid woman with a skeptical look on her face, said, Maybe we ought to get a lawyer. We don't know what we're doing here. Virgil didn't want any of that and said to her, You can call a lawyer. Then we'll all go down to jail, and I'll have them booked for obstruction of justice and abetting a murder after the fact, and you can put up your house's bail to get them out. Now, I need the information. I'll get it one way or another. But if we screw around for 3 days and somebody else is murdered while Jerry sits on the information I need to catch the killer, then I'll put his aging ass in prison, and your mother's too, and they'll stay there until they die. All right? That got Gerald going again, and Virgil hardened his face, and when Gerald got it under control, he said, "It was the man on the moon party." Virgil closed his eyes, feeling like he'd just crossed a mountaintop, and said, "Oh, shit, a party, not a man." On July 20th, 1969, the day that Apollo 11 landed the first man on the moon, Johnstone said Bill Judd Sr. had a party at his house on Buffalo Ridge to watch the crescent moon come up. The state park had not yet gone in, and the road up to the house was nothing more than a long gravel driveway coming over the back of the hill to the back of the house. The party was right in the heart of the Bill Judd tomcatting days. 7 or 8 women and 4 or 5 men, some of the women local, 2 or 3 of them entertainers from the cities. "I honest to God don't know what happened up there," Johnstone said. "All I know is what I heard through the back door. They supposedly had some cocaine, maybe, and plenty of liquor, of course, and were generally up there raising hell. They also had a cookout going. So late that night, one of the girls, but maybe not one of the girls, this is what's crazy, because you're not going to get a bunch of guys, you know, having sex relations with a woman who's 9 months pregnant. I don't even know if she could." He looked at his wife, who said, "It'd be uncomfortable." Johnstone started to tap dance. "You hear things over the years. What I'm telling you could be all wrong. Just tell me, Gerald," Virgil said. "I'll sort it out." "The story was, something happened between this woman and Judd. The other people were out in the yard with a telescope, seeing if they could see the men on the moon. There wasn't any chance, of course, but they had this telescope, and they were way up in the ridge, and they were drunk." "Gerald, the pregnant woman." Johnstone nodded. "So late at night, they're out there, and they see a car that looks like it's coming off the driveway. It's going down the hill, away from the party. Sort of aimed down this crease in the hillside, and people are going crazy, yelling. They think the woman in it is drunk and lost, and they run down that way. And damned if she doesn't drive the car right off Buffalo Jump," he said. "The bluff. Right below Judd's house. Supposedly Indians used to stampede buffalo right off the cliff. So this car goes over the side, and people are running around yelling and screaming. Judd comes running out of the house, and then he and a couple of guys jump in a car, and they go tearing down the driveway and around to the bottom of the jump. And in the meantime, one of the other girls said, 'She's got to be hurt bad.' So they called the fire department, and the fire boys got a rescue truck headed out that way." "She was killed," Virgil said. "Yeah, but not right then. She was what we call brain dead now. She had head injuries and neck injuries, but her heart was still going when Judd and the other guys pulled her out of the car. Then the fire boys got there, and they hauled her over to the hospital. She died in the emergency room, but the doctor..." "Gleason," Virgil said. Johnstone stared at his daughter for a long time. 10 seconds, 15. And then he sighed and said, "Yeah, Russell Gleason. Russ delivered the baby. Tough delivery, but the baby lived. There was a story in the paper, called it the miracle baby." "So why would somebody kill Gleason for delivering the baby?" Virgil asked. "If he was there at the emergency room, he couldn't have been at the party. He had nothing to do with the woman." "That I can't tell you," Johnstone said. "I can tell you a rumor, and I can tell you a thought that passed through my mind." Virgil flicked his fingers at Johnstone, a gimme gesture. Johnstone said, "There was a rumor that the woman hadn't been there for the party, hadn't been invited, that she came down on her own from the cities, in her own car, and that she'd been there before the party and had had a fight with Bill. Bill could be rough as a cob. Nobody knows what happened, but there were rumors that he wasn't right there with everybody else when they saw the car rolling down the hill. He came running out of the house a minute or so later. The question was, where was he when the car came off the driveway? Once it came off the driveway, going down that seam in the hill, it was going to go over the bluff. Was the woman committing suicide? Why didn't she turn or put on the brakes? Or was she dead unconscious when she went in the car? Virgil asked. Did somebody else steer it off the driveway? Johnstone's head bobbed. It could have been done. Could have rolled the car down to the seam, let it go, run back over the shoulder of the hill. This was at night, remember? And then up and into the house, and then out the front. Was there any suggestion of that at the time? Virgil asked. Johnstone shook his head. Nope. Was there an investigation? Quick nod. Roman Schmidt, Virgil said. Yep. Jerry, you really messed this up, Virgil said, lying back in the rocker and letting it rock a few times. God help you if anybody else gets killed in the next couple of days before I can figure this out. He rocked a few more times and then remembered. You said a thought passed through your mind. Yeah. Johnstone reached up with both hands and scratched his head above his ears and then said, I didn't want to tell you all of this because I really don't know anything. But I remember when I saw that girl's body on the dressing table, all bashed up in the accident. Cut up in the hospital. How'd she get those bruises? Some of the bruises were fresh, but they weren't 15 minutes old. They didn't develop between the time she died and the time she went off Buffalo Jump. They were hours old. But the doctor said she died in the accident. The sheriff... What happened to the miracle baby? Virgil asked. Adopted out, Johnstone said. I don't know the details to that. But the baby was adopted out. Baby boy. Virgil left them scared. You stay here. You're at risk. But if it took Shrake and Jenkins a whole day to track you down, I don't think the killer will get you. If you decide you don't want to stay here, if it starts to feel hinky, get out to a motel. You don't have to go far to be completely lost. If you do that, you let me know. I'll give you my cell phone. Out in his car, he went through the name file on his computer, called Dr. Joe Klein. It's that fucking Flowers, Klein said when he came up. What do you want? You going out? No, I'm reading Proust, 50 pages a night all summer, Klein said. I'm 42 pages in on tonight's quota. Sounds like a great read. You gotta have a quota, Virgil said. That's how I read a chemistry book one time. Great chatting with you, Virgil, Klein said. Just being sociable, Virgil said. How's the old lady? What do you want? I want to come over to your house and have you look at a photograph, Virgil said. Will this be billable? Hell, I don't know. I doubt it. Klein was the Hennepin County medical examiner. He gave Virgil directions to his home in Edina, north and west across town from Apple Valley. Virgil was at his front door in 20 minutes. Klein's wife, Kate, met him at the door. She was tall, thin, with a sharp nose and gold-rimmed glasses. Give me a hug, you big lug, she said. He did, and she felt kind of good. Klein said, that's enough of that. What's the picture? They took it into his home office. Kate, a pediatrician, looked over their shoulders as Klein inspected it with a magnifying glass. Klein hemmed and hawed a bit, and finally his wife said, My God, Joseph, you're not in federal court. Spit it out. Klein tapped the photo, the woman's ribcage. Your undertaker is right. If she died in 15 or 20 minutes, these bruises didn't come from the accident. Besides, I've seen bruises like this before. This is what you get when somebody dies after a bar fight. When somebody gets beat bad with a pool cue, you see this striping effect, if it has time to develop. Say there's a bar fight. A guy gets beat bad, dies the next day. This is what you see. If he dies right at the scene, you don't see it. Virgil called Johnstone. Gerald, did you ever go up to Judd's house?
Oh, yeah, several times. I wasn't real popular with him because I was the mortician and he was sort of superstitious. But I did go a few times.
Did he have a pool table?
Oh, sure. He had everything. Swimming pool, pool room, hot tub. He had all that stuff. The joke was his decorator was Playboy magazine.
Kate Klein said, pool room?
Yep.
God, you lead such a neat life, she said. If only you were a rich doctor, I might have married you.
You would have had to get in line, Klein said. This boy's been married so often he's got rice burns on his face.
Chapter 16. Virgil left Klein's. Saturday night, nowhere to go. He thought about calling Davenport, but he'd been leaning on Davenport too hard and decided to let it go. Instead, he checked into the St. Paul Hotel, put on a fresh pair of jeans, a Flaming Lips t-shirt, buffed up his boots, and headed over to the Minnesota Music Cafe for a couple of beers. Bumped into Shrake, who was there with a big-haired secretary from the Department of Agriculture. She said she dated him because he had a big gun. Then Shrake wanted to know what happened with the Johnstones, and a couple of St. Paul cops came over, and Virgil danced with a woman who had a butterfly tattoo around her navel. He'd gone back for a third beer when a woman's hand slipped into his back jeans pocket, and a familiar voice said, "I'd know that little bud anywhere." He turned and said, "Goddamn, Jeannie, how have you been?" She said, "Okay." And to a girlfriend she said, "This is my first ex-husband, Virgil Flowers. I'm either his second or third ex-wife, I forget which." "Be nice," Virgil said. He looked her over, and she did look okay. Prosperous, even. "Still in real estate?" She rolled her eyes. "Yes. Shouldn't admit it, the way it's fallen out of bed, but nothing like selling a house. Makes me feel good." So they chatted a while, and he started remembering some of the better times they'd had. And then she patted him on the chest and said, "Guess what? I might get married again."
"Hey, great man," Virgil said. "Anybody I know?"
"No, no. He's at Wells Fargo, a vice president in the mortgage department. Known him for years."
"And he's available because?"
She shrugged.
"His marriage broke up. Same old stuff. Everybody works, nobody talks."
"You got kids?" Virgil asked.
"Two, but he'd like a couple more."
"Does he dance?" She laughed.
"Not like you, Virgil."
"He does, but
like a banker."
"Ouch."
Pretty good time, all in all, and he danced with the girlfriend a couple of times, and at 1 o'clock in the morning, a little drunk, rolled into bed at the hotel, all alone. Thought about God for a while. Sunday. Not exactly hungover, but a little lonely. He got cleaned up, got breakfast, checked out of the hotel, and drove over to the Historical Society. The library was closed. He called around, and the duty officer, which was not her title, but what she did, led him to the microfilm machines and got him the missing roll of microfilm. He spooled through it, found the paper that came out on July 24th, the first one after the Man in the Moon party. And there it was. A miracle baby was delivered to a 29-year-old Minneapolis woman moments before she died at the Blue Stem Memorial Hospital emergency room Sunday night after an automobile accident on Buffalo Ridge. Margaret Maggie Lane, of 604 Washington Avenue, Minneapolis, apparently lost control of her car as she was leaving a Man in the Moon party at the home of William Judd Sr. Witnesses say the car plunged over the Buffalo Jump Bluff after leaving the driveway 50 yards below the Judd house. An autopsy revealed 0.07% blood alcohol below the legal limit, and Judd said that Maggie had only a glass of wine or two during the party. "This is an awful tragedy," Judd said. "She was a warm, interesting woman, and nobody ever had a thing bad to say about her." Stark County Sheriff Roman Schmidt said that deputies interviewed all the partygoers. They were satisfied that Lane's death was accidental. She'd only been to the Judd house a couple of times. She wasn't legally drunk, but she may have had enough that she became confused as she was leaving and turned the wrong way as she came over the shoulder of the hill, Schmidt said. A witness called the volunteer fire department, and a rescue squad reached the car within 10 minutes. Lane was taken to the emergency room, where Dr. Russell Gleason delivered a healthy 7-pound, 4-ounce full-term baby, even as the boy's mother was dying of extensive and what Gleason called surely fatal brain injuries. The baby will be remanded to the care of Minnesota Child Protective Services. There was one bad photograph of the wrecked car sitting at the base of the bluff. The picture had been taken with a flash of some kind. Were flash bulbs still used by news photographers in 1969? There were a few white faces in the background, unrecognizable, and three cops close to the car. One of them was a young, big curly. The next paper came out on July 31st, and oddly, Virgil thought, there was no mention of the miracle baby. Not a single word. In his hometown, he thought, there would have been recurring stories for a month. He went to the dailies at Worthington and Sioux Falls and found stories similar to that from the Blue Stem Record. But the dailies were farther away, and the death happened the same day of the first manned landing on the moon, and so was tucked away in the back of the papers. He thought about it for a while, then called Stryker and told him about the story. "You know, I've never heard that," Stryker said. "You would have thought I'd have heard it. I mean, it'd be something that people talked about." "Got drowned out by the noise from the moon landing," Virgil said. "So go over to the hospital and find out what happened to the kid. I mean, kick somebody's ass off the golf course and find out where he went. I'll do that." Virgil hung out at the Historical Society for a while, looking at an exhibit on early photography, all those Civil War guys with white eyes and stolid faces. Stryker called back. "Nothing there. I mean, there's something there, but it's nothing. The child was turned over to protective services on August 2nd. That's it. You'll have to work it from that end." "And it's Sunday." Stryker. "Wonder what's happening with the DEA? That's what I'm wondering. If I stay up here and it goes down tomorrow, I could miss it." "Well, get the research chick to work it," Stryker suggested. "Get back here. I've been thinking about it, and it's all fur. No mystery, no weirdness, just fur." "Give me the logic," Virgil said. "We've got a series of huge crimes, murders," Stryker said. "Then we find out there's a professional criminal right in our backyard selling dope all over the country, and he's been doing it for years. Back at the beginning, he needed seed money to get started, and he needed a way to hide the operation. That's about the time all these little farmer-sponsored ethanol plants were popping up. This crime we know about, with fur, involves some of the same people involved in the others, the Judds. I don't know how you tie the Gleasons in, but I could see a reason for Roman Schmidt. Schmidt was monitoring the cops through the Curleys. The Curleys might not even have known about the rest of it. You say Schmidt was willing to cover up a murder, take money for it. When you've done it once, you'll do it again. In fact, the Judds might even have pulled him into it." "I don't know," Virgil said. "If somebody had to kill the Gleasons, they could have done it in a quiet way. Kill them, but don't pose them. Try to make it look like a murder-suicide, something. But the way it was done was nuts." "Got your head up your ass, Virgil. It's fur." Virgil scratched his nose, made the call. "I'm coming back." He was back by 5 o'clock, having stopped in Mankato to check his mail, pay bills, and run a load of laundry through the washer and dryer. Before he left home, he went into his closet and took out his third most favorite deer rifle, a Browning lightweight Stalker semi-auto in .30-06, an extra magazine, and a box of cartridges. The rifle wasn't as accurate as his best bolt action, but it was as accurate as he was, and could put some heavy metal on a target in a big hurry. Heading west, into the sun, he could feel some kind of climax just over the horizon. Too many things going on not to have something shake loose. That night they went out to Barnett's Supper Club in Sioux Falls, 5 of them, Stryker and Jesse Lehman, Virgil and Joan, and Laura Stryker. There was one tough moment on the way over when Laura told Jesse that she should get Stryker to take her up swimming at the Dell some hot night. Jesse giggled and admitted that they'd already been.
Then Joan and Virgil had to spontaneously join in the teasing of Stryker, and they pulled it off. And then the three women began working on Virgil and Stryker. Something was up with the case, they knew, but Virgil and Stryker weren't talking. Later that evening, Virgil was looking at the jukebox when Laura Stryker came by, on the way back to their table from the women's room, and she stopped and asked, "Are you and Joni going to get serious? You look like it." "Not that serious," Virgil said. "She gave me a little talk. I'm not husband material. I'm her transition guy." "Damn it. I need a grandchild," Laura said. "I want to be around long enough that my grandchild can remember his grandmother." "You've got a few years," Virgil said. "I've got enough years to be a great-grandmother," Laura said. "But one side of the family stops when Joan's clock runs out. I think Jim and Jesse, I think I've got something going there." They both turned and looked at Joan, who was leaning across their table, making a point to Stryker and Jesse. "She'll be okay," Virgil said. "I'm her transition guy, but I wouldn't be surprised if she has somebody picked out on the other side of the transition zone." "I hope so," Laura said, "or I'd suggest that you go ahead and knock her up." Before they left, Virgil went out in the parking lot and called Sandy, Davenport's researcher, who had just gotten back from a weekend trip. "Goddammit, honey, you picked a bad time to go away. I need you to get some stuff for me tomorrow morning. And I need you to rain fire and brimstone on anybody who stands in your way. A woman named Margaret Lane, also known as Maggie, was killed in an auto accident on July 20th, 1969. He gave her the rest of the details and said, "Find that kid." Monday. Virgil woke up in Joan's bed. She was lying flat on her back, her head cocked off to one side, and a less charitable man might have said that she was snoring, if only softly. She was wearing a T-shirt as a nightgown, and had pushed down the sheet. He pulled it up to her chin, then slipped out of his side of the bed, yawned, stretched, did some sit-ups and push-ups, as quietly as he could, then got his clothes and walked naked down the hall to the bathroom. He used her toothpaste, which was a cinnamon-flavored gel, and scrubbed his teeth with his index finger. When he came back down the hall, pulling yesterday's shirt over his head, she cracked her eyes and said, "I'm not getting up yet." "That's okay." He looked at his watch. 7:45. I'm heading back to the motel. Call you later?" "Call me later," she said, and closed her eyes and snuggled into the bed. He pulled on his boots, lifted the sheet, looked at her ass, said, "Masterpiece," and went on out the door. A neighbor was fooling with his sprinkler system, and when Virgil came off her porch, he raised a hand and called, "How are you doing, Virgil?" "Doing good," Virgil said. "I bet you are," the neighbor said with cheerful, barefaced envy. At the motel, he cleaned up, chose a Decemberist's T-shirt, which he saved for days that he felt might be decisive, and called Sandy. "Geez, Virgil, I hardly got started. The baby was processed through the Good Hope Adoption Service, which seems like it might not exist anymore. I'm trying to find out what happened to their records. I'm also working it the other way, through Child Protective Services. Call me the minute you get anything. I want to know every step of the way." She called back in 10 minutes, as Virgil was sitting in the restaurant, eating pancakes and link sausage. "I've got something, but it's not specific yet." "What is it?" "It's the list of Child Protective Service adoption actions through the district court. I can't get the files themselves without jumping through my butt, which I'm willing to do, but there are dozens of them, and I've only got one butt." Virgil was shocked. "Sandy, you don't talk that way." "I'm a little cranky this morning," she said. "Anyway, what I can get, without permission, is the file headers, which I can pull up on my computer. These are the names of the adoptive parents. They're organized by year, and there are, let me see, about 170 files for 1969. If the adoptions are randomly distributed through the year, and I don't see why they wouldn't be, the adoption of baby boy Lane would have taken place in the last half of the year, and probably the last 4 or 5 months. I can read the names of the 85 adoptive couples and see if anything rings a bell." "Can you get the file afterwards?" Virgil asked.
We might need to do some legal stuff, but I can get Lucas to do that, she said.
Read the names.
She started. Gregory, Nelson, Snyder. He stopped her when she said, Williamson,
Williamson.
Williamson, David, and Louise.
You gotta be kidding me, Virgil said.
Yank the file?
Yank the file. Call me as soon as you get it.
Virgil blew past Stryker's sullen secretary into his office, shut the door, and leaned across Stryker's desk. Stryker's mouth open and asked, What do you know about Todd Williamson?
Stryker said, Todd? Came here 3 years ago. Pisses me off sometimes. What are we talking about?
He's the miracle baby. And after thinking about it, thinking about what Judd's sister-in-law said, about looking at him in the middle of his face, I think he might be Judd's natural son. From his eyebrows to his lips, he looks like a Judd.
Oh. Stryker held his hands up in the air. What next?
Jeez. Something else occurred to me. He's the dog that didn't bark, Virgil said.
What?
He's at every crime scene. He knows everything. But I didn't see him at the Judd fire.
Where the hell was he?
The fire trucks went out there with their sirens screaming. Where was Williamson?
Stryker said, I don't know. Maybe running away from it?
Virgil nodded. He's the guy. Bet you a dollar. They were talking to the judge about a search warrant when Sandy called again. Lucas screamed at a man at CPS and they won't cough the file without a court order, but the guy confirmed, off the record, that the kid was Baby Boy Lane.
I will kiss you on the lips next time I'm up there, Virgil said.
I'll look forward to it, she said primly.
The judge suggested that there was little evidence to support a search warrant.
Stryker said, Randy, goddammit, don't dog us around with some pissant evidence bullshit. It's about 50% that Todd is the killer, and he's gonna do it again. I want to get all over him before he has a chance.
What if you don't find anything? He's gonna sue your pants off, the judge said.
Not my pants, the county's pants, Stryker said. If I don't solve this case pretty damn quick, I'm gonna lose my job anyway, so why should I care? Sign the warrant.
Okay, okay, keep your shirt on.
Outside the judge's office, warrant in hand, Virgil said, Your judicial efficiency is a marvel.
Out here you take care of yourself, Stryker said.
They brought in Larry Jensen, the investigator, and four other deputies. Stryker and two of the deputies took the newspaper office. Virgil, Jensen, and two more deputies headed for Williamson's home.
Call me every 5 minutes, tell me what you got, Stryker said.
Find a 357.
Find a typewriter, Virgil said.
Williamson lived in a square, flat, single-story white house with a flat-roofed garage set farther back and a long screen porch on the front in an old neighborhood on the east side of town. From Williamson's house, Virgil thought, getting to the Gleasons would have been a snap. Williamson was 2 blocks from the riverbank. In the heavy rain, the night of the murders, he could have walked over to the bridge across the river, off the far end of the bridge, along the riverbank, and up the slope to Gleason's. After the killings, he could be back home in 15 minutes. No muss, no fuss, no cars in the night. And that, he thought, was why the killings may have taken place during a thunderstorm. The neighbors wouldn't be out, and everybody would have been snuggled up in front of the TV. Virgil drove over, alone in his truck, because he'd learned that if he went to a crime scene in somebody else's vehicle, he'd need to leave before they did, or after they did. Jensen and the other 2 cops followed in 2 sheriff's patrol cars. Virgil stopped in front of the house, and the deputies pulled into the driveway, 1 car going all the way to the garage to cover the back door. They got out, watching the doors. Virgil with a hand on his weapon, Jensen with a hand on his own. The screen door was open, and he and Jensen went through, hammered on the front door. No answer. Tried the door. Locked. Jensen said, Wait one. He went out to his car, brought back a long shaft maglite,
and used the butt end to knock out a pane of glass in the door. Reaching through, he flipped the lock.
"We're in."
They cleared the place, making sure that Williamson wasn't inside, then started pulling it apart. The furniture was comfortable but old, as if it had come from a high-end, used furniture place. There were six rooms, all on the first floor. Kitchen, small dining room, living room, good-sized bath, a bedroom used as a home office, and the actual bedroom. Exterior doors leading out through the kitchen to the garage and out the front. Virgil took the bedroom, Jensen took the office, one of the other deputies did the kitchen. Virgil opened and emptied all the drawers, worked through the closet, checking all the pockets and all the clothes, checked the walls and baseboards for hidey holes, plugged a lamp into the outlets to make sure they were real, turned and patted the mattress, lifted and turned the box springs, lifted the braided rug. The only thing he found of even the remotest interest was a half-dozen vintage penthouse magazines featuring well-thumbed, hardcore porn stashed under the corner of the bed within easy reach. Jensen was hung up in the office. "A lot of paper," he said, looking up from the office chair, his lap full of files. "So far, nothing about being adopted. Got job stuff. He was in the army in Iraq in 90, in supply. No guns at all." The cop in the kitchen had come up empty, and had then gone out to the garage, gotten a stepladder, and now had his head poked through a hatch that led into a space under the roof. "Lots of insulation," he said. "Lots of dust. Doesn't look like it's been opened in years." Virgil was working through the living room. Found another stash of porn, this on video, behind the DVD player. When he heard the deputy outside calling, Hey, Todd, hold it, Todd. Virgil drew his pistol, felt Jensen moving in the office, and then Williamson came through the screen door and the front door on the run. Virgil, from the corner of his eye, could see through the porch screen that Williamson's car had been dumped in the street, the door still open. Williamson's hands were empty, but he was screaming and came straight at Virgil, and Virgil pushed the weapon back into the holster, and when Williamson kept coming, hands up, he took one wrist and turned him, pushed him, and Jensen was there to push him again, and the other cop came in from the kitchen, and the outside deputy ran in the front door, his pistol drawn, and Virgil turned to Williamson, and Virgil was shouting, "Hands overhead! Hands on the wall! On the wall!" Williamson shouted, "What the fuck are you doing? What the fuck is going on?" But he put his hands on the wall, and Virgil patted him down. "What the fuck?" Virgil said, "You can slow down, or we'll have to put some handcuffs on you. Calm down, you can step away from the wall." Williamson's face was dead red, and he was breathing like a man having a heart attack. "What the hell is going on?" "We're searching your house. We have a warrant." Williamson's mouth worked, but nothing came out for a minute. And then Virgil saw him relax, make the small move that meant he'd gotten it together. Virgil stepped back. "You okay?" Williamson, still angry, but not uncontrolled. "What are you doing?" "We're looking for anything that might tie you to the murders of the Gleasons, the Schmidts, and Bill Judd."
"What? What?"
"We know about your adoption," Virgil said.
"My adoption? My adoption?"
His mouth hung open for a moment, then,
"What about my adoption?"
"You were born here in Bluestem when your mother was killed in an automobile accident after a party at Bill Judd's. You're Bill Judd's son." Williamson actually staggered back away from Virgil.
"That's not possible. How is that possible? That's horseshit."
"You didn't know?" Virgil was skeptical.
"No," Williamson shouted. "I didn't. I don't believe it. My mother..."
He reeled away.
"My mother got pregnant and gave me up for adoption. Didn't want me. That's what my mom told me. My real mom."
"Your real mom?"
"My real parents."
Williamson's face had gone from red to white, and now was going red again.
"David and Louise Williamson, where did you get this bullshit?"
He looked around.
"What have you done to my house? What have you done? You motherfuckers are gonna pay for this."
They cooled him off, and Virgil told him bluntly, "We're going through here inch by inch. Frankly, it's not possible that you wound up here by accident.
Not by accident? Not by accident,
William said. I was working up in Edina, at the Suburban Papers, and Bill. It was Bill, not me. My editor met Bill at an editor and publisher meeting. My guy came back and said Judd had seen some of my stuff and wondered if I'd be open to working in a small town.
So you left Edina and moved to Bluestem?
Virgil's eyebrow went up. Not a common thing to do.
Williamson looked around and said, "Okay if I sit down?"
Virgil nodded, and he dropped onto a couch and wiped his sweaty forehead on the sleeve of his shirt.
"Look, I was working in the cities. I was making $38,000 a year, and it wasn't going to get any better. I learned journalism in the Army. I don't have a college degree. The big papers were losing staff. Everything was going in the toilet. So Judd says, come on down to Bluestem. I'll pay you $40,000 a year and vouch for you, so you can get a mortgage."
Williamson looked around the house.
"You know how much this place cost?"
Virgil shook his head, but Jensen said, "I think it was up for $45,000.
"They took 40.
I'm paying $200 a month for a pretty decent house. In the cities, I lived in a slum apartment that cost me $800 a month. The job wasn't going to get any better either, even if the paper survived. Out here," he shrugged, "I've got my own house. I'm sort of a big shot. I like the work."
The anger flooded back. "So go ahead and search, you fuckers. There's nothing here because I had nothing to do with any murders."
To Jensen, "You know where I was when the Gleasons were killed? I was at the Firehouse Funder down at Mitchell's. There were 300 people there, and I was reporting it, and I gave a talk." He started shouting again. "You think about asking me for an alibi?"
"Take it easy."
Still shouting. "And that stuff about Bill being my father. I want to see some proof. I want to see some DNA. Hey, you got a warrant? Are you searching the office?"
Williamson was out in the kitchen, getting a cup of coffee, watched by a deputy, when Jensen said to Virgil,
"That was an act. It was a pretty good act."
"If he did the murders, he's a psycho," Virgil said. "Psychos spend their lives fooling people."
"You want the dining room? I'll take the garage."
Chapter 17. Monday afternoon. Cumulus clouds were thick as cotton balls in a hospital room, some of the bottoms turning blue. More thunderstorms coming in. Stryker was sitting at his desk, fingers knitted behind his ear, heels on the corner of his desk, staring out the window across the parking lot. Virgil sat across from him, saying not much. Finally, Stryker yawned, stretched, dropped his feet to the floor, and said,
"Well, that was your basic clusterfuck."
"There's a connection in there. Gotta be," Virgil said.
"I will bet you $100 American that he's the guy."
"It was $1 this morning."
$100, Virgil repeated.
"Straight up, $100?
Virgil thought about it for a moment, then said, "You'd have to give me 2-1.
Stryker tried to laugh, then shook his head, said, "Damn it, he's gonna crucify us Thursday morning."
"Then we need to give him a better story," Virgil said. "I'm thinking about calling Pirelli, see what he has to say for himself."
"You do that," Stryker said, standing up. "I've got to run over to the jail. If I don't see you later, I'll see you tomorrow."
Virgil wandered out of the office, stopped at the men's room. The second best place to think after a shower was a nice, quiet urinal. Williamson claimed that Judd found him, that he hadn't found Judd. That had a certain straightforward logic to it that appealed to Stryker. If Williamson was Judd's kid, Judd would have known it. Was it possible that as he'd gotten old, and maybe started to think about what was coming, maybe started to read a little revelation, that he'd softened up and gathered his children around him? Was that why his will wasn't in the safe deposit box? Had he been thinking of changing it? Would that have given Junior reason to get rid of the old man? On the other hand, Williamson's alibi, that he'd been at the Firehouse Funder, was too convenient for Virgil's taste. The fundraiser had been held at Mitchell's, the local sports bar. Mitchell's back door emptied into an extra parking lot. From the parking lot to the Gleason's house was a 5-minute jog along the railroad tracks, then across the bridge and up the hill. All suitably dark. and by 10 o'clock, the eating had been over for 2 hours, and the drinking had gotten underway. Would anybody have noticed if Todd Williamson, so evident around the place all evening, had slipped away for 25 minutes, had not gone to the John, but out the back door? As far as Virgil was concerned, the alibi was far short of watertight. Stryker disagreed. Fuck him. He was washing his hands when a deputy stepped in, glanced at the two empty toilet booths, then said, "I need a word with you, but I don't want it getting out that I talked to you." Virgil shrugged. "Sure, but what?" The deputy's name tag said Merrill. He was nervous and blunt. He wore gold-rimmed glasses and a brush mustache. "But this is a murder case," Virgil said. "If you've got something to say, you ought to say it. I can't promise to hold it confidentially." Merrill rubbed his nose, looked at the door, and then said, "I saw you up to the fire at Judd's." Virgil nodded. Let the guy talk. "So this is probably nothing, and that's why I hate to say anything, but..." "Say it. I ain't gonna bite," Virgil said. "Jesse Lehman was there, drinking beer, rubbernecking." "Yeah? Well, she's seeing the sheriff, socially. Everybody knows that. The thing is, I know her truck, and I didn't see it come in, and I didn't see it go. I never saw her ride off with any of the other people there. I know about everybody in the county, everybody who was up there, and I've been asking around. I can't find anybody who took her or who brought her in. It was raining like a cow pissing on a flat rock. Seems odd to think that she walked in." "She had a can of beer in her hand when I saw her," Virgil said. "Yep," Merrill said. "I assumed that she came up with the folks from the bar, but I can't find anybody she rode with." "You sure you'd know her truck?" "Man, Jessie is one of the hottest chicks in the county. I know her truck. I wave at her every time I see her." Virgil looked at him for a minute, then said, "Keep your mouth shut on this. You gonna do something about it?" "I will." Buffalo Ridge was something like the hill at the Stryker farm, but 20 or 50 times as large, covered with knee-high blue-stem grass, outcrops of the red rock, with a spring, a stream, and a lake on the north side, and Judd's house and the Buffalo Jump Bluff on the southeast. There were park roads both north and south. The south road came off a state highway and curled around the top of the mound. Halfway to the top, Judd's driveway broke off to the east to the home site, now just a hole in the ground. Virgil took the drive, parked next to the foundation hole. He got out and looked in. The ash had been worked over with rakes. Looking for a safe, Virgil thought. Junior hoping for a will. Okay. If he were going to kill a man and set fire to his house, how would he run? Wouldn't run south because you'd fall over the bluff and kill yourself. Wouldn't go east because there was nothing there but a lot of hillside, weeds, and rocks. You could break a leg in the dark. You could run back down the drive to the park road, then down the park road to the entrance. Would you get to the entrance before the fire department? Must be a mile or more, and the fire department had a couple of first responders on duty all the time. If you were in a car or a truck, you could get down there in a minute, but running, even with a small flashlight, would take you 8 minutes or so. Or you could go north, climbing the hill, and then circling around. That would be more dangerous, again risking rocks and holes, but you could take it slow in the rain and work up behind the rubberneckers. He knew the road, so he walked the north route across the hillside, came over the top, saw the first of the buffalo. They were far enough away not to be a problem, but he kept an eye on them, and they kept an eye on him. The day was still warm, close to perfect, but the clouds were thickening up. He zigzagged, looking for a trail, a break that somebody might have followed through the high grass, but saw nothing in particular. And the going was rough. He tried walking with his eyes closed and floundered around like a two-legged goat. He looked back at the road. The road was it. Back in Bluestem, He walked down to Judd Jr.'s office. His secretary was standing in the door of the inner office talking and stopped when Virgil came in. She said, "Mr. Flowers is here." Judd stepped into Virgil's line of view, cracked a smile. "You got old Todd hung from a light post yet?"
"Not yet," Virgil said. "I need to talk to you for a minute."
Judd pointed at a chair and said to the secretary, "Run up to Rexall and get me a sleeve of popcorn." She wanted to stay and listen, but shook her head and shuffled off. Virgil waited until she was gone. Judd said, "I don't need any more family members, Mr. Flowers. I already had one too many."
"Yeah, well, I guess you should have talked to your father about that," Virgil said.
He asked, "Who cut your father's lawn? Who cut that piece of short grass out between the house and the bluff? I didn't see any lawnmowers on the garage pad." Judd was puzzled. "Well, he had all of his yard care done by Stark Gardens. They got a greenhouse and do lawn care and cleanup. Why?"
"Trying to nail a few things down. Who might have been coming and going?" Virgil said.
"The night of the fire, do you have any idea of how long it took the fire department to get up there?"
Judd shook his head.
"You could ask them, but I imagine, let me see, somebody had to call it in, then the guys had to get going, had to get through town. Doesn't seem long, but I bet it was 8 or 10 minutes.
"Okay." Virgil stood up. "Thanks."
Judd said, leaning back in his leather chair, "I'd like to know something, just between you and me, private."
"Ask," Virgil said.
"You getting anywhere?"
Virgil said, "I think so. I feel like things are about to break."
Judd said, "Jesus, I hope. I made some calls up to the cities to ask about you. Word was you're pretty good. I need to stop walking around feeling like there's a crosshairs on my neck."
Virgil thought about Pirelli and his DEA crew.
"I can sympathize. You could be excused for feeling a little twitchy right now."
At the sheriff's office, he asked for Margot Carr, the crime scene tech. She worked the North County as a full-time deputy when she wasn't doing crime scene work, he was told. He borrowed a radio and called her.